is Tuesday, August 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. As the Taliban continue their push to take provincial capitals, the United States deploys aircraft to support Afghan government forces.
To come in, doing patrols, and basically helping out in areas where the U.S. is able to communicate with Afghan troops on the ground.
Plus, the U.S., Britain, and Canada roll out new sanctions on Belarus, and how the fires in Greece are affecting some migrating birds. These stories and more next. The Taliban continue to ramp up their ground offensive against Afghanistan government forces, overrunning another provincial capital. A lawmaker told media that the Taliban were fighting government forces in Aibak, the capital of the northern province of Samagan. Other lawmakers say that the city fell without resistance. VOA has not been able to independently verify the events surrounding the attack in Aibak. The United Nations Children's Emergency Fund, or UNICEF, reports that during the past 3 days of fighting, at least 20 children have been killed and another 130 have been injured in Kandahar province. The agency also reported child deaths in Khost and Paktia provinces, saying, quote, "These atrocities are also evidence of the brutal nature and scale of violence in Afghanistan, which preys on already vulnerable children," end quote. The Taliban advance comes on the same day that the U.S. Pentagon confirmed that it was deploying an array of aircraft to support government forces. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden joins us with the details. Jeff, what exactly do we know about the deployment of U.S. aircraft in support of Afghan forces?
Well, we know that the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes for weeks now, even while the withdrawal has gone along and is almost complete, as it has been for a while now. The U.S. has had some of its platforms, and we're being told now that a lot of it is coming down to its AC-130 gunships and its MQ-9 Reaper drones flying over Afghanistan from afar, from places elsewhere in the Middle East, to come in doing patrols and basically helping out in areas where the U.S. is able to communicate with Afghan troops on the ground. And the focus has been, for the most part, in areas like Kandahar, Herat, and Lashkargah, where the Taliban have been pressing offensives and the Afghan government has sent some of its special forces to hold those key areas. Of course, at the same time, the Taliban have been pushing their offensive in other areas, and according to the Pentagon, in about the last 72 hours, have taken a total of about 5 provincial capitals. So U.S. air power is coming down. They also have B-52s that are coming from Al Udeid Air Base in the Middle East, and they also have F-18s, Stryker bombers that are able to launch from the carrier strike group that the U.S. has positioned in the Persian Gulf. But again, these are long-range flights, and so there's an impact, but in some ways a limited impact in terms of helping the Afghan forces on the ground that are facing just what appears to be a tsunami of Taliban forces trying to overrun key areas.
Speaking of the onslaught of Taliban offensives, has the Pentagon commented directly on the status of the fighting in Afghanistan? Have they said, are they going to do anything more, perhaps with more of the so-called over-the-horizon attacks?
Well, everything right now is over the horizon. There is no other option. The U.S. presence in Afghanistan in terms of its military presence really limited to Kabul and the embassy area, and then also to the international airport outside of Kabul. And that's it. There are no more airstrikes that can come from within Afghanistan. So everything is coming from afar right now in terms of what the U.S. can do to help out. In terms of how that fight's been going, the Pentagon today said it is not going in the right direction, according to the press secretary who was briefing reporters. And the press secretary, John Kirby, said that the U.S. will continue to support Afghan forces, but the focus continues to be on completing the war drawdown, the U.S. drawdown, by the end of the month. And he refused to speculate what U.S. support for Afghan forces might look like after that August 31st deadline, at which time the U.S. military withdrawal will be complete. The Pentagon, in response to a VOA question today, said that if Afghan troops don't put up much of a fight, there's really not much the U.S. can do to help them. Because, again, time element. And the other thing is to note, it just in terms of perspective, that after August 31st, there will be over-the-horizon airstrikes if needed, but it's going to be to counter-terrorism. Countering the Taliban is not considered counter-terrorism. Just for perspective, U.S. airstrikes may continue, but in terms of the authorities that are in place, there are no authorities that we're aware of right now, or nothing that's been changed that would allow the U.S. after August 31st to continue airstrikes in support of Afghan government forces.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. On Monday, Pakistan said the international community needs to look into the meltdown of Afghan security forces in the face of Taliban offenses across Afghanistan instead of blaming Pakistan for the fast deteriorating situation. The comment comes as diplomatic sources tell VOA the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan, Salmeh Khalilzad, and his counterparts from Russia, China, and Pakistan will meet in the Qatari capital of Doha on Wednesday under what is officially known as the Extended Troika. That meeting will be preceded by a meeting on Tuesday of Afghanistan's immediate neighbors. Russia, the United Nations, and the United States have also been invited to Tuesday's meeting. But what impact can those meetings actually have? Joining us to discuss their potential impact is Jeff Smith, South Asia Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. Jeff, where I want to begin is, given the current level of fighting in Afghanistan, I want to get your take on the talks that are going to take place Tuesday and Wednesday in Doha, and what, if anything, you think the impact of those discussions may have on the situation in Afghanistan.
Well, sadly, I'm not optimistic. There have been multiple rounds of negotiations and multiple formats involving multiple parties over the course of the past 20 years, including, most importantly, direct talks between the U.S. and the Taliban and even some intra-Afghan negotiations. And sadly, none of them have made a major contribution toward ending the violence in the country. And so it strains belief to assume that these talks are going to be fundamentally different.
You mentioned the talks that have been taking place for years now, in addition between international parties and the intra-Afghan talks. You know, the international community is continuing to ask the Afghans to sit down to the table to come about with a ceasefire with the Pakistani government, doing so again on Monday. It hasn't happened. What pressure can the international community levy on the Taliban to bring about a ceasefire and sit down with the government of Ashraf Ghani to bring about peace in the country?
Sadly, I think the leverage of the international community is very limited. We've been exploring these questions now for well over a decade, nearly 20 years, and we haven't been able to find leverage to bring the Taliban to the negotiating table. Unfortunately, the leverage the international community does have that may be relevant is over Pakistan. I don't think it's used that leverage appropriately, but I think there are mixes of incentives, carrots and sticks, that could be used to incentivize Islamabad to put more pressure on the Taliban to come to the negotiating table. Taliban relies on safe haven and support inside Pakistan to keep this insurgency going. And I think if the international community does want to use its leverage to bring an end to the conflict, that's where it should be directed.
Do you see any concern for perhaps conflict spilling out beyond the borders of Afghanistan and in the regional countries?
Yes, absolutely. That's very possible. I think the Taliban would prefer to keep the conflict within Afghanistan's borders, at least for now. I don't think they would like to see further coalescing of regional countries against them. And so for now, I think they're trying to keep both the fighters within their own ranks and also allied militant groups, trying to prevent them from extending their jihad beyond Afghanistan's borders. But the more unstable the situation grows and the more control the Taliban has under its territory, I think the greater likelihood we see a range of different Islamist groups operating with different agendas that can include those neighboring countries.
So moving forward, if we take a look at the fighting that's taking place in Afghanistan, the talks that are taking place in Doha, the reduction of U.S. and NATO forces, what are you closely following to see which direction the things may move into in terms of either establishing peace in the country or, you know, having conflict persist?
Well, I'm actually looking more at conditions on the ground in Afghanistan rather than the outcome of these talks. You know, while it is probably true that a end to the conflict will be brought about by some sort of political agreement, I don't think the parties to the conflict, particularly the Taliban, are ready for that negotiated settlement. I think they're still waiting to see how the battles on the ground play out. And it's very much an open question now whether the Taliban will be able to continue this military offensive, seizing more and more provincial capitals, getting closer and closer to Kabul, or whether the Afghan National Security Forces are going to be able to mount a stiffer resistance in some of these urban areas, which will change the balance of leverage at the negotiation. So unfortunately, I don't think the diplomatic track right now is the most important line to watch. It's what's happening on the ground.
The Heritage Foundation's South Asia Research Fellow, Jeff Smith. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. France's extensions to its COVID-19 health pass came into effect on Monday, with restaurants, trains, and commercial centers required to make checks before allowing people in. Reuters' Emer McCarthy has those details.
On Paris's iconic terraces, it's coffee and QR codes. Romain de Crenzo is a restaurant manager in the Montmartre district.
Since this morning, we've refused dozens of people, unfortunately, either because they don't have the pass or they're not vaccinated. For those who aren't vaccinated, it's understandable, but there are those who have forgotten to get the pass, so they go home, or they go get their coffee in another place, whereas they could have had it here.
Tens of thousands have protested across France against the health pass, with more than 230,000 taking part in demonstrations on Saturday. The protesters accused President Emmanuel Macron of trampling on their freedoms. He says freedoms carry responsibilities that include protecting the health of others. Vaccination rates jumped after Macron unveiled his health pass plans last month. Two-thirds of all French people have now received one dose and 55% are fully vaccinated. Issam Fakir, who works in logistics, is just one who rolled up his sleeves.
I have a somewhat divided opinion on the health pass, to be honest. I've gotten vaccinated because it's my job. It's important. At one point, I knew that I would be blocked, so I did it. But beyond that, it doesn't really bother me. Now it's something that's on the mobile phone. It's with me, so it doesn't bother me when I'm asked for it, because I've done it.
From Monday, people will have to show a health pass to eat in a restaurant, access non-emergency treatment in a hospital, or travel on an intercity train. They will already need it to access swimming pools, museums, and nightclubs. Health employees have until September 15 to get their vaccinations or face suspension.
Emer McCarthy of Reuters News. Some people are finding ways to get around COVID-19 health passes with fake vaccine cards. Associated Press correspondent Rita Foley has that story.
More and more colleges and universities are requiring proof of COVID-19 vaccination for students, but now there's a way to cheat the system. A cottage industry has sprung up across the internet, selling fake COVID vaccination cards to those who say they won't get a COVID shot for either personal or religious reasons. There's an Instagram account that sells COVID cards for $25 each. A user on the encrypted messaging app Telegram offers what they call COVID vaccine card certificates for as much as $200 a piece. Some sellers on websites are asking almost $500 for fake vaccine cards, certificates, and passports. In April, attorneys general in almost every state asked the CEOs of Twitter, Shopify, and eBay to take down ads or links selling the bogus cards. Many sites have blacklisted keywords related to fake cards, but places to buy them are still popping up on messaging apps, chat forums, and the dark web. Are people buying them? One Reddit user said on a thread about fake cards, "I need one too, for college. I refuse to be a guinea pig." I'm Rita Foley.
With the world a year and a half into the pandemic, the United States, India, and Brazil have suffered the most cases of COVID-19 as well as deaths from the virus thus far. That's according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. The United States has recorded the most cases in the world, with just shy of 35.9 million contracting the novel coronavirus, which led to over 617,000 deaths. India and Brazil round out the top three, with nearly 32 million and over 20 million cases, respectively. Globally, there have been 4.4 billion vaccine doses administered. And as of Monday, Canada is lifting its prohibition on Americans crossing the border, but the U.S. is not ready to reciprocate. AP correspondent Mike Hempen continues our coverage.
U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents must be fully vaccinated, fill out a detailed application, and test negative for COVID-19 within 3 days of visiting Canada. The Canadian government says travelers should plan for the possibility of additional processing time at the border. However, the U.S. plans to extend its border closure to all Canadians making non-essential trips until at least August 21st. The U.S.-Canada border has been closed to non-essential travel since March of last year. I'm Mike Hempen.
There's growing discontent among Lebanese, with political and military powerhouse Hezbollah calling the shots in the country. Analysts say a 2006-style confrontation with Israel, which bolstered its militia image then, is not an option for the Iran-backed Hezbollah now, as it's seen as part of the problem, not the solution. Even Lebanon's influential Maronite Catholic Patriarch is calling on the beleaguered country's army to confront Hezbollah for the sake of Lebanon. Dale Gavlak has that story.
Lebanese analyst Daniel Holiat-Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut says that as Hezbollah has been accumulating and projecting power, it has simultaneously increased discontent among its opponents and positioned itself as a threat to others, seen most recently in a revenge killing involving a Sunni Muslim Arab tribe. Writing in the Saudi Arab News Daily, she says the incident showed that Hezbollah is not as invincible as it once seemed and that it can be intimidated. This encouraged protesters to chant anti-Hezbollah slogans at the commemoration last week of the deadly 2020 Beirut bombing, Khatib says, with fingers pointing at the group for illegally bringing tons of ammonium nitrate into Beirut port. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah has denied that the group has ever controlled Lebanese government or that it has a majority that would allow it to act on its own, according to the Arab Weekly online publication. Nasrallah has also repeatedly denied accusations that Hezbollah has maintained an arms warehouse at Beirut port or could be responsible for the tragic port blast. "We have nothing in the port, not an arms depot, nor a missile depot, nor missiles, nor rifles, nor bombs, nor bullets, nor ammonium nitrate," he said in a televised speech shortly after the blast. Angry protests over corruption by the country's entrenched political elites now feature more public condemnation of Hezbollah, accusing the militia and political party with lawmakers in parliament of selling out their country to Iran. Mona Yacoubian of the United States Institute of Peace told London's Chatham House Research Group that Hezbollah has evolved from championing the resistance to Israeli occupation to becoming the Praetorian Guard of Lebanon's corrupt cronyist system.
Hezbollah over years has increasingly exploited state institutions, parliament, ministry, civil service, and used its influence to garner power, to spread patronage, to gain revenues. It has enmeshed itself into this very corrupt system. In the October 2019 protests and beyond, we see that Hezbollah is no longer viewed as above corruption. It has been tarnished by this behavior, even within its own base, that there's growing disaffection, and even its own reaction to the protests, seeking to quell them. What does this say about the trajectory of both the group and the country?
Lebanon's influential Maronite Catholic Patriarch Bashar Boutros al-Rai urged the army during his Sunday Mass to confront Hezbollah for the sake of Lebanon. We call upon the Lebanese army, which is responsible with the international forces for the security of the South, to take control of the entire lands of the South, to prevent the launching of missiles from Lebanese territory, not for the sake of Israel's safety, but rather for the safety of Lebanon, he said, quoted by Lebanon's national news agency. Al-Rai said that he could not accept that a party decides peace and war outside the national decision entrusted to two-thirds of the members of the government. He referred to 19 rockets fired from southern Lebanon into northern Israel on August 6. Some were intercepted and others fell in open spaces. There were no casualties. Analyst Dania Cholilat Khatib says Hezbollah should make the conscious decision to downsize, to dismantle its resistance brigades and ask for other armed groups to also disarm in order to secure its own survival and spare Lebanon from a destructive confrontation. Dale Gablack for VOA News, Amman.
The United States, in coordination with Britain and Canada, rolled out new sanctions on Belarus Monday, the one-year anniversary of the start of protests in the Eastern European country against elections that were widely seen as fraudulent. Since that time, Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko has taken harsh action against peaceful demonstrators and political opponents. Actions by Washington, as well as Ottawa and London, are targeting the construction, energy, potash, and tobacco industries of Minsk, which the U.S. Treasury Department described as the wallets of the Lukashenko government. In response to the British sanctions, which were announced earlier in the day, Lukashenko told reporters on Monday that Britain could, quote, choke on them.
This is Science in a Minute.
Medications that include opioids have long been used as effective painkillers. But according to the Mayo Clinic's website, even brief use of opioids can lead to addiction and overdose. Opioid misuse and overuse have become a serious public health crisis in countries the world over, including the United States. Findings in a recent study by researchers at Canada's McMaster University show that using alternative painkillers may help cut down the dependence on these addictive medications. The researchers writing in the Canadian Medical Association Journal found that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen are actually better at controlling pain than opioid-based codeine painkillers. The study adds that there are fewer undesirable reactions with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs than codeine. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. On Monday, the World Food Program said that aid from the United Nations has only reached half of its intended recipients, the Tigray region of Ethiopia. The WFP said it delivered food to 1 million people in war-torn Tigray in both June and July, but that shortages of fuel and telecommunications mean that another 1 million people slated to receive assistance have been out of reach. The United Nations has estimated that 5.2 million people, 90% of the population of Tigray, is in need of food assistance. Humans are unequivocally to blame for global climate change, and massive cuts to greenhouse gas emissions are urgently required if the world is to avoid catastrophic warming, according to a report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that was published on Monday. Its findings are approved by 195 world governments, and Henry Ridgewell takes it from here.
On the Greek island of Evia, residents flee their homes beneath a sky of burning red as fires consume pristine forests turned to tinder by searing summer heat. This is just one of hundreds of intense fires burning across Greece, Turkey and Italy as summer temperatures have topped 45 degrees Celsius. The message from scientists, climate change is here. Professor Levent Kurnaz is a climate scientist at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul.
The Mediterranean will be having these forest fires all the time. Therefore, I mean, this is just the beginning. It's going to get much worse.
Intense heat and drought have triggered fires from the Mediterranean to Siberia to California. The report, compiled by 200 scientists from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, says temperatures have already risen by 1.1 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The United Nations Secretary General described the findings as code red for humanity. Co Barrett from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is a vice chair of the IPCC.
This report tells us that each of the past four decades has been the warmest on record since pre-industrial times. Further, it is indisputable that human activities are causing climate change. Human influence is making extreme climate events, including heat waves, heavy rainfall, and droughts, more frequent and severe.
The report warns that global average temperatures will hit 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by 2030 on current trajectories, the limit agreed at the Paris Climate Summit in 2015 and seen as a tipping point by many scientists. That's 10 years earlier than previous forecasts. The report adds that sea level rises of up to 2 meters by the end of the century can't be ruled out, threatening millions of people living in coastal areas. And the Arctic is likely to see at least one ice-free summer by 2050. But scientists emphasize there is a way out. The worst scenarios can be prevented and global warming reversed with drastic cuts to global emissions. Professor Bill Collins is an author of the IPCC report and a climate scientist at Reading University.
These aren't just small changes we can make. These aren't just sort of tinkering at the edges. These really mean whole-scale changes of the way we use and consume energy. Carbon dioxide is the main one which we need to get to zero emissions by the middle of the century. But we've also shown that methane is an important gas to reduce. It's caused maybe as much as half a degree of the warming we've already seen.
With the United States rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement under President Joe Biden, scientists hope there will be added momentum as world leaders gather in November for the COP26 Global Climate Summit in Britain. Biden's envoy for climate, John Kerry, said Monday that all major economies must commit to aggressive climate action during this critical decade. Again, Professor Bill Collins.
It's actually commissioned by the world's governments, this report. So we're providing information that they want, that they say they need to make political decisions.
Those decisions will decide whether humanity can avert catastrophic climate change. Its impact is already being felt in many parts of the world. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Now, piggybacking off of Henry Ridgewell's climate change report, Reuters' Lauren Anthony has this story about how the wildfires in Greece are affecting migrating storks.
Wildfires raging in Greece for the past week have proven an unexpected adversary for migrating storks. The birds heading to Africa are losing their way en route and crashing into city power lines after becoming disorientated. That's according to animal welfare group Anima. Its president, Maria Ganotti, says the storks are being found in places totally unrelated to their migration.
Because the animals are upset, they fall onto electricity poles and are electrocuted on the cables. We have many storks. It's the first time we have had so many dead storks in Athens, not since another event that took place 12 years ago. People in Athens are picking up dead storks from their lawns.
Every year, storks coming from Central Europe and Northern Greece cross the Attica region. They gather about 45 miles southeast of the capital, waiting for favorable northern winds to help carry them across the Mediterranean into Africa for the winter. Ganotti estimates that some 20 storks have perished so far trying to do this trip. At least 4 are being treated at Anima's first aid center. Once they heal, they'll be taken to the eastern Greek coast, where they'll be released to continue their journey with other herds flying south. But the storks aren't the only animals suffering because of the fires. Anima is taking care of other 6 species too.
Some of the animals that are here will die. The turtles, for example, if they have inhaled a lot of smoke and have been burned internally, they will not be able to eat and they will die. You can't do anything about that.
By Monday, the fires had been contained in Attica, but the devastation left behind will take a long time to repair.
Lauren Anthony reports for Reuters News. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.